I'm driving into work one day, and there's this spewing, this fountain of water coming out of the side of the building. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, holy God, what is that? And I said, I don't remember that being a design feature.
That was the voice of Mac Banner, and this is Inside Asia, conversations with Asia's leading movers, shakers, thinkers, and provocateurs. I'm Steve Stein, and thanks for joining. The future of healthcare is as big an issue in Asia as it is elsewhere, maybe even more so. As Inside Asia listeners know, it's a subject we've breached before. In an earlier episode, we spoke with Clancy Houston, a former CEO of one of China's new private sector hospitals. We grappled with the subject of doctor shortages and changing disease patterns and how the Chinese healthcare system was scrambling to keep up with the new demands. In another episode, we listened to Rosalind Chow Ku, founder and CEO of CXA Group. We talked about disrupting the healthcare insurance sector by using big data to tailor policies to consumer needs. In this episode, it's Mac Banner, longtime Asia executive, former hospital CEO, and a senior healthcare advisor. Mac spent 31 years in Asia before heading back to the States. I caught up with him just as he was packing his bags, and we spoke together on the 32nd floor of the Conrad Hotel in Singapore. It was a kind of sad, sweet moment and a bit of a trip down memory lane. I asked him about his extraordinary career and his three decades operating in the healthcare sector all across the region.
What brought me to Asia was Hospital Corporation of America. I was working for at the time. I was in Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, running their Middle East operations. They had the prospect of buying the Glen Eagles Hospital, which at that time was owned by a trust, and the trustees, mainly bankers, they wanted to divest themselves of this and get out of the hospital business. And
now, Glen Eagles was in Singapore at the time, one of the first private hospitals in Singapore.
Yeah, it was an old black and white house that they had expanded into. It was a small, relatively small hospital. They expanded it from an old black and white. And they went through a process to sell the hospital, and the Parkway Group, which at that point was a property group with a well-known shopping center out on the East Coast, they bought the hospital, and that sort of launched them eventually to become the largest healthcare private hospital company in Asia.
So we're talking about ground zero. There was really nothing in the form of formalized private healthcare in Asia or in Singapore at that time.
Well, at that time, that was 1985, not really. About that same time, National Medical Enterprises, which was it was a U.S. company that subsequently became Tenet Healthcare, I think they had just bought over the Mount Elizabeth Hospital from local, I think they was previously owned by some Indonesian owners. And they had already entered the market in 1985. But I was out not with NME or Tenet Healthcare. I was out with HCA with a prospect of buying the Glen Eagles Hospital.
But you came out, but you were sitting at that time in Saudi Arabia, were you? Or were you still back in the U.S.?
No, I had been in Saudi Arabia for about 4 years with HCA. Mm. So I originally went overseas by going to Taif, Saudi Arabia.
And that's a tough first posting, no doubt. And then when Singapore came up, this was really just an opportunity to stay overseas. Was it your decision or your employer's decision?
Well, I looked at it as I'd died and gone to heaven. I mean, I've been 4 years in Saudi Arabia, and they said, would you like to go to Singapore? And of course, you come to Singapore, and it's like coming to Disneyland. You know, it was like paradise. So I was very happy. You know, I gleefully said, you betcha.
Disneyland where you can drink.
Yes.
The best kind of Disneyland.
Right. Exactly.
So a little bit. So you when they came, they looked at the deal and they needed professional management, hospital management, and they looked to you. And they said, Mac, would you like the job? Now, what was that initial job?
Well, the initial job was to come out and help a gentleman that they had had posted in Singapore for several years. And they thought that they had a good chance of buying the Glen Eagles Hospital from this trust. But it turned out Parkway outbid them. And so they turned around and said, well, we don't have a job for you because we didn't get the hospitals. We don't have anything for you to operate. So then I went back to California, and I spent 4 years in California before returning to Asia in 1991, this time with National Medical Enterprises, Tenet Healthcare. And that's when I was at Subang Jaya Medical Center, and we met.
I understand. So you got your first taste of what's possible. You got a glimpse of the future when you first came to Singapore, but you actually didn't set down feet and really get started until you came back later.
Yeah, 91. One thing that was interesting, that was my first experience of going back to the States after having been an expat in Saudi Arabia and Singapore for about 5 years. And it was very sobering and very depressing, because they don't teach you, nobody prepares you to go back to the States after you've had a posting overseas. And many times when you're posted overseas, you get experiences and challenges and so on and so forth that are actually far more advanced than you would get in the States at a much earlier age. And you've got far more flexibility, you've got far more everything. And then you go back to the States and you're sitting, you really are trying to fit back into a system that is fairly constrained.
So you knew at that point, having been back, that once you tasted the fruit, you wanted to be back in Asia Pacific or back overseas where you had that flexibility and some of those liberties.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of depressing to be back. And, you know, here I am in Los Angeles, which is a pretty exciting city, and, you know, I had a challenging job and all, and that was all good. But, you know, when your heart is with the excitement of being in Asia, and I feel like I've been one of the luckiest people in the world to live the last 25, 30 years in what I think is the most dynamic place in the whole earth.
Yeah. You know what's amazing to me? After all these years, you haven't lost your accent, Mac. You still have that Virginia Southern gentleman, you know, lilt. And I'm just wondering, I guess as you head back, it's the one thing you can say you held on to through all the years. In addition to some of your graces and your manners, because you are a very gracious man. But I'm just it's interesting to me that now you're at a point where you're thinking you've had this wonderful 25, 30 years, 31 years. You are going to head back, but you want to stay close to the market in many ways. We're going to talk about that a little later in the program, but I want you to paint a picture for us on what Asia, and particularly Southeast Asia, looked like when you arrived. What was the healthcare scene? What was the situation? What were some of the kind of issues and challenges that the government and the population faced when it came to receiving quality healthcare services?
Let me first comment on sort of the overall development, particularly in Malaysia, because when I was in Malaysia, I went there in 1991. My office was on the sixth floor of the Subang Jaya Medical Center, and you could look out the window of my office looking north, and there were no houses you could see, no houses at all.
So, what were you looking at?
Well, you were basically looking at barren land that the Sime Darby that owned Subang Jaya Medical Center, they had bought a property development company that was developing Subang Jaya. And just beyond the hospital, it basically was barren land that was destined for development. But as far as you could see over into the horizon, there were no houses.
So this was build it and they will come idea.
Oh, yeah. And then this was 1991. So when I was getting ready to leave Malaysia and come to Singapore.
What year was that?
That was, well, actually, when I was leaving the hospital, that was 97. I stayed in Malaysia for two more years, but 97, I was leaving the hospital, and I went up to my old office that we'd converted into some patient care areas then, but I was looking out the same window, and it's about 5 miles or so, or maybe 10 miles, over to the mountains, and you couldn't see the ground. It was all housing and development, various things. And, you know, and it struck me. I thought, wow, just in 8 years, 7 years, it had just transformed tremendously over a relatively short period of time. Same way in private hospitals. When I went there, there were probably about maybe about four or five good private hospitals in Kuala Lumpur, in the greater Kuala Lumpur area. When I left, I bet there were 15 or 20.
And this is just part of that enormous economic surge that we saw during the late 80s, early 90s, that moved on into the 2000s. It's been a massive expansion, and many governments around the region, even in Malaysia, were setting up planned communities because the old parts of the city were all bogged in and you couldn't build out or expand. So this was actually something that the government has had master plans against, and I guess Subang Jaya was kind of one of the centerpieces in this community. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, that was Subang Jaya was a mega planned city that kept growing well beyond its original plans, and it became a huge city in its own right, and a destination within Kuala Lumpur all in its own right. And there are many other examples of that all around Kuala Lumpur, just sprawling with these little enclaves of developments and then commercial areas, and then inevitably they would put a hospital close by, and they've all been successful.
What's this is at a time when many healthcare services across the region were primarily publicly funded, government supported. Why was there this all of a sudden this enormous surge of desire to bring private healthcare into the mix?
Meet the demand. You got people that are going up the economic ladder, they've got disposable income, and generally speaking, all over the world, your public sector hospitals are tax dependent, they're supported by taxes, and usually they're constrained by budget constrained. So you end up with overcrowding facilities and long queues for service, no choice of your doctor, and so on and so forth. And so when a private sector is introduced into these emerging economies, as the people get the money, they'll choose to go to the private sector for healthcare.
Yeah. And then tell us a little bit about what it was like to manage in Malaysia at that time. You'd been in Saudi Arabia, as you alluded to before, but there were some particular cultural and people management challenges. Can you give us a couple examples of what you faced when you arrived and how you changed people's ideas about what good service looked like?
I think one of the biggest differences when going there from I'd spent probably a combination of about 10 years in the U.S., about 5 in Virginia and 5 in California. To come to Malaysia, one of the things I had to end up sort of urging everyone and preaching everybody and scolding everybody was to spend the CapEx money to keep up for capital maintenance. In other words, there's such a thrift culture in much of Asia, and particularly in Malaysia, that the plant operations team, I mean, they would duct tape stuff together, and I used to scold them and say, don't do that. Spend the money that we have allocated to maintain the place, because it's penny wise and pound foolish not to do it.
So are we talking about MRIs and X-ray machines, or are we talking just about wheelchairs?
Well, we're not talking too much about MRIs and X-ray machines, because we did have contracts. But even those, you could get the contract from the original vendor, or there were small local private companies that said we can fix them cheaper and better. We can fix them just as well and keep maintaining them just as well for less money than so on and so. Then you had to worry about are the replacements part genuine, so on and so forth. But that was one of the challenges.
So did you find out about these things after the fact, or was it kind of proactively you were just maintaining a drumbeat of what needed to be done in order to shift the mindset around what it is to run a professional private hospital?
I'd say it was a combination. The first year or so, you sort of find out, well, wait a minute, you're not doing this, and you'd preach or scold, do whatever you have to do to get the maintenance sort of up to speed and into the to a level that you needed to maintain in order to present yourself as a first-class facility.
Yeah. There must be one or two stories in here. Can you think of one where you just said it was one of those oh my God moments, like I can't believe that just happened, and there's a learning in here, or anything that comes to mind?
Well, I'll tell you a story. This was we were building a new center, an extension, and we had operating theaters and beds, and we were about two or three days from opening. You know, they were going to release it from the contractor to us, and we were going to start doing the commissioning and all that. And I'm driving into work one day, and there's this spewing, this fountain of water coming out of the side of the building. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, holy God, what is that? And I said, I don't remember that being a design feature. We had some fountain coming out. It was like at the fifth floor. So I go in, and I said, what? You know, what's this water shooting out of the side of the hospital, the new building? They said, oh, we have a problem. I said, yeah, you bet. he said, as it turns out, the people that were building it, it was in our operating theaters and in our CSSD, our Central Sterile Supply Department, and they have steam sterilizers, and you've got copper piping that was specified to for the exhaust relief or for the steam release out of the sterilizers, and the people that were installing it, they took the copper piping and repurposed it and put in PCB piping. Well, of course, the first time they're testing it, and they're testing it just before they're handing it over to us, the PCB piping gets the steam, it disintegrates, all that water comes out, steam comes out, turns into water, and starts shooting out of the building. So yeah. this was one of those examples I'm thinking, okay, they're trying to be thrifty. And well, actually, the subcontractors had stolen what right. They'd stolen the pipes, but
we call that thrifty in Asia.
Yeah. So, but it was one of those ones where I just thought, okay, gonna have to be a little more on top of at the project control group meetings about specifying not only to verify that the materials are going in.
And you mentioned that many of these early stage private hospital groups were property developers to begin with, and building codes were in their infancy as well across many parts of Asia. So cutting corners wasn't necessarily something unusual. It was something that we'd seen for decades. But they probably, many people, perhaps they didn't understand the importance of building to spec for a hospital when people's lives are on the line.
I think that's a good... That's a good overall characterization of the different levels of sophisticated everything at that time in Asia compared to where it was in the States. I'll give you a good example. One of our competitor groups had built a hospital over in Ampang area of KL.
Where is that? Just the same general, Kuala Lumpur is the capital of Malaysia and is a large municipal area, about what, 6 to 10 million strong, isn't it?
Yeah, I think probably that or more now, but it's a big metropolis now. But anyway, I knew the lady that ran this group, and we served on the Private Hospital Association board together, and she invited me over to see this facility that just opened, and we were standing there overlooking the thing, had taken the tour, and I said, how did you guys do your decision to build this hospital? Sharon said, look at that, and she pointed out the window at the intersection. She said, see all that traffic?
That was it. Lots of people.
Yeah, I said, see all that traffic? He said, we just said, this is a space. And I thought, well, that is hospital planning 101, Malaysia style.
Right.
But it was a very successful hospital, and they did a wonderful job. But, it wasn't some big sophisticated thing that said, here's a population, here's the age of the population, here's a strata, here's the income distribution of this population, how many of them have disposable income, all the stuff that you would have done ad nauseum in the States. It was just, look at that traffic.
Yeah, and this speaks to the pioneering attitude of those, that initial wave of expats who moved in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. You experienced all this, and another time and place, all of this would have fallen over. But you know, lo and behold, economic expansion was in full stride in Asia Pacific. So it's almost you couldn't fail in many ways if you just built in these areas where there were high population densities or high population growth rates. Yeah.
Yeah, to a point, that's exactly right. I think there is where the failures would come in is when you would build too early and you weren't able to attract the doctors to come to your location. Here's a good Subang Jaya was actually a good example of that. It struggled in the first 4 or 5 years because the property developer built this hospital way on the outside of KL at that time. And the doctors were all practicing in town. And they weren't willing to drive out the 35, 40 minutes to an hour to come out to Subang Jaya to see two patients when they could sit in their clinic in town and see 10 patients or 15, 20 patients in the same time. So what happened was Sime Darby was able to give them good property deals on the housing out there, so they actually moved out into Subang Jaya, and that's when the hospital took off, because the doctors were there close by and they had, you know, a steady presence. Same thing right now is going on. There's a brand new hospital in Ho Chi Minh. I won't mention it, but
in Vietnam.
We looked at this last year, and beautiful hospital, absolutely beautiful hospital. We were touring the hospital about 11 o'clock in the morning. You could take a bowling ball and roll down through the lobby.
Yeah. Did you do that, Mac?
I didn't do that. If I had one, yeah. I wouldn't have hit anybody.
Right.
I wouldn't hit anybody. I didn't see a patient for the whole. So here you've got, you know, I don't know how much this thing costs them. Maybe, let's just say it costs them $75 to $100 million to build. And then you've got no patients, and you've got minimal staffing, but you've got to pay them. So, and eventually the population will move out to that area, and it eventually will probably be successful. But they've got they're just built too early, too much, too early, too quick.
But isn't this the same story you were mentioning in KL or in Malaysia and elsewhere? I mean, it's part of the wave. And Vietnam is probably about 15, 20 years behind developmentally from the core Southeast Asia countries of Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, and the Philippines. Do you think that their strategy could bear fruits just the way it has in these other markets?
I think it will eventually. I think also that they're... we've talked about this a little earlier about other things, on another episode. But you have leapfrog opportunities in Vietnam that I think are there, where they can go straight to the latest delivery mechanisms without going through the evolutionary processes of these shop lot GPs and then the, you know, group practices and so on and so forth. They can go to multidisciplinary ambulatory care centers that are linked to a hospital either locally or here in Singapore. And that'll be, I think, will be the future in Vietnam.
I'm Steve Stein. My guest is Mac Banner. He's in the process of looking back over a career that spans 3 decades in healthcare in various parts of Asia. Mac was just telling me about how certain Asian healthcare markets like Vietnam have a distinct advantage over providers in more developed markets like the US. In some ways, Asian medical institutions are less constrained by conventional and oftentimes more costly healthcare protocols. It prompted an interesting question. In what ways can a market's underdevelopment prove an advantage? It's a phenomenon borne out in other industry sectors as well. Take telecommunications, for instance. While developing markets poured billions into capital-intensive fixed-line networks throughout the 1970s and 80s, Asian markets had neither the means nor the consumer spending power to do the same. Then came mobile technology in the 1990s, and overnight, Asia became the fastest growing cellular market in the world, virtually leapfrogging the West and rolling out mobile services to serve billions of first-time subscribers.
I asked Mac if the same possibilities might exist in healthcare delivery. While Western markets have spent lavishly to deliver high-cost, technology-driven healthcare solutions for patients in developed markets, so has the price of care and the cost of insurance escalated. In being late to the party with respect to private sector care, might Asian markets be in a position to deploy lower-cost healthcare solutions?
My view is there are about four or five major changes that are coming across medicine globally, and the U.S. and, I guess to a lesser extent, Europe have a lot of legacy systems, mostly tied to the financing, the way healthcare is paid for, but also just regulatory systems about how medications are approved and that sort of thing, that are much, in my opinion, much too complicated and too burdensome. And Asia doesn't have those. So they're leapfrog opportunities. So let's just go through the major changes that I see on the horizon. One is just the science of medicine. And most people will know about this, things like stem cell applications, the Human Genome Project, molecular medicine. It's just the way that the scientists, the medical scientists are developing to individually to treat conditions are just, it's just exploding.
So this is basically bringing it down to individual care instead of just a generic, across the board, categorized, pharmaceutical solution for an individual. Now it can be tailored to that genetic makeup of the individual.
Exactly. And that's been talked about probably about 10 years or more.
So where's the advantage for Asian hospitals or the Asian healthcare sector versus U.S. or elsewhere?
Well, I'll get to that in a minute. I mean, I think this is where the leapfrog comes in. If I can cover all the other one is the miniaturization of the technology. That, used to be that the labs had to be these big, big machines, big equipment, big facilities, so on and so forth, but increasingly they're being miniaturized, and that makes them portable, and it makes them, so for instance, there's a group out of South Africa that now offer an online hearing test rather than having to go into those soundproof booths that you used to have to go into.
So you're talking about now, so I see. All right, so we're now looking at all of the enormous capital costs that went towards large high-tech equipment like MRIs, labs, other kind of, can now, hearing tests, whatever the case may be. These can be managed remotely, or they can even be provided at incrementally smaller costs.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a group that I've gotten to know here in Singapore that are looking at developing a molecular portable laboratory tests for certain features of a lab. And then these are the things that you used to have to send off to a reference lab and wait 3 or 4 days for the results to come back. And now they're going to be able to sit as a portable device on a doctor's desk and give you an answer in 20 minutes. So, there's a big, if you don't have all of this invested, and rather than buy a $200,000 machine that you used to have to buy or send them off to the university lab, you can buy a $5,000 or $10,000 machine and put it in your local doctor's office, and you can give somebody results in 20 minutes. That's a big change.
Major cost savings, right? Yeah. Across the board.
Yeah. The third big change is basically a combination of cognitive computing and access to big data. And IBM Watson was, I'm sure your listeners are going to know all about IBM Watson. They went on Jeopardy in like 2011, and they developed that, and they applied it to medicine, specifically to oncology. That's where they're focusing.
This is IBM's experiments and developments in artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and basically the treatment of big data and to be able to analyze it. There's a book that I recommend everybody read called Smart Machines, and it gives sort of the history of, well, IBM's history, but more the history of cognitive computing. I try to explain it in a way that me being a layman halfway understands.
Okay. But in the healthcare space, the importance of data.
Okay, now. Then the fourth one, I'll get to the fourth one and come back to it, and that is speech recognition and the mobilization of all this technology. So you got four things. The last two, I think, combine to change what I think is going to change the role of doctors and, to an extent, the role of hospitals and the servicing of people as patients, the potential. And that is just like the marketing world has changed rather dramatically over the last 4 or 5 years to being, rather than just publicizing this is what we have, to being able to say this is what you're interested in and this is tailored just for you.
Yeah. Targeted marketing.
Targeted marketing. It's going to be targeted healthcare. Yeah.
So you can target the patient and say, we know your makeup, therefore we think you need X.
Yeah, and you can give them guidance. You can give them, and you know how, you know, like now you got an ache, you got a pain, you got, you know, you think you're something's the matter with you. You Google it, and you get all this generic stuff, and you got to try to sort through it. Well, all that's going to change.
But there's issues of privacy here, and that's a very particular issue within the healthcare medical fields, right?
Yeah, it is something, and I'm just assuming that. That can be addressed. I'm not a IT person, but you just figure that they'll figure out, the people that do this sort of thing will figure out how to allow that thing, the information that is personal to you, to be able to be secure. And the latest that I've read about is this whole blockchain technology, and I don't know whether that's applicable here or not. But yeah. There are ways that you can encode this data, yeah. I think, yeah. and protect it.
Well, there is a combination. It's several combinations. There's the data analytics and the right. ability to process data sufficiently and efficiently. There's the access to internet and a web of information that's available on people, whether they want you to receive it or not. And then ultimately, it probably is an opt-in where a patient will have to say, I choose to be party to this, and therefore I am prepared to hand over information about my medical or healthcare condition, right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We were in a meeting the other. I was in a lecture by Jeremy Lim. Bangkok about 2 years ago, and somebody raised a question about, well, what about the protection of data, and you know, what about all the privacy? And I said, you nuts! You're basically giving up all your rights to privacy every time you put I agree on all of this thing. If you go, if you click beyond that, if you click and see what you're agreeing to,
the small type.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're giving up all your right to privacy, but everyone does it. Everyone does it willingly because you want to be able to access whatever it is that is.
Yeah. So this is just part of the greater consumer trend, whether it's e-commerce, target marketing, identifying and pairing, you know, a product or a service to an individual based on preferences and behaviors.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we are making these choices. It's funny because the dialogue is we want to protect ourselves and protect ourselves. You know, we want to protect our privacy. We want to do all this and the sanctity of data and everything. But the reality is we check the box and we give it up.
This is Inside Asia, and thanks for listening. My guest was Mac Banner, longtime and now retired Asia healthcare executive. Mac has been looking back over a career in healthcare spanning decades. More important, he offers perspective not only on what has been, but what could be. Central to the theme is technology. Mac plays it forward and looks to the future of healthcare, presenting us with what technology has to offer the medical profession. Each week, we like to tie things up with what we call in Indonesia a bungkus, a sort of final thought or wrap-up to the episode. And this week's is, frankly, a little harder than most. Healthcare is a complex issue, and to be frank, there's a lot to say. In Asia, the future of healthcare has a lot to do with the numbers, of people, that is. And it's not just the population growth we're talking about, but rather the migration of people from country to city. From 2000 to 2010, an astonishing 200 million people moved into urban areas throughout Asia, a rate expected to grow between 3 to 5% annually for the foreseeable future. Throughout Asia, there are more than 800 urban areas in full bloom, including 8 megacities with populations of more than 10 million people each. It's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, migration stories in human history. In terms of economic development, it's been a good thing. Higher incomes, better education, modern telecommunications, you name it. But there's a dark side to development. Put simply, living in cities is hazardous to your health. Move to a city and you can count on higher levels of contagious disease, poor air and water quality, higher levels of stress, and less healthy eating habits. We could cite a lot of stats to help make the point, but here are two that tell the tale. According to the World Health Organization, a staggering 10% of adults in China, or 100 million people, live with diabetes. Another 230 million suffer from at least one type of cardiovascular condition, with another 120 million heart patients entering the healthcare system between now and 2030. How to accommodate the demands born of shifting healthcare patterns is the billion-dollar question. Just as technology through the last quarter century has driven the cost of healthcare higher with newfangled diagnostic machines, customized cancer treatments, and implantable medical devices, is it possible that the latest wave of digital technology actually works to reduce costs just at a moment when Asia is facing the threat of healthcare cost inflation? As Mac Banner points out, we're only at the beginning when it comes to identifying ways to apply technology to lower the cost of care. It won't come easily. There's resistance, particularly from an entrenched medical institution that places doctors on a pedestal. Physicians don't like to be challenged or substituted, and that's precisely what new breakthroughs in medical diagnostics, data analysis, and remote monitoring threaten to do. Patients aren't sold either. Most of us want to look the doctor in the eye, vest in their expertise, and leave comforted by their diagnosis. In this world of big data, many of us worry that healthcare privacy could be compromised. Do we really want to be sharing our blood pressure stats online or allow an app on our iPhone to prescribe a drug? It's a leap of faith, to say the least. But it's also the future. What if it could be shown that you can get better, more accurate, more personalized care through digital technology? What then? Would you take the leap? Surrender those long waits at the doctor's office for something better, faster, more accurate? There was a time when people laughed about the utility of mobile phones, online banking, and a world without travel agents. People now snicker at self-driving cars and artificial intelligence. Will they laugh when remote sensors anticipate a heart attack, triggering a warning and allowing for a life-saving injection all in the blink of an eye? I think not. For a full discussion on these issues, you can head over to the DHR International website. Click on the Insights section and take a look at a recent white paper I've written on the subject. The future of healthcare is a boundless topic and more than we could possibly cover in one episode. But there's more to come, so stay tuned. To download our other episodes on healthcare and related topics, or on any number of other topics, visit us at www.insideasiapodcast.com. Or if you prefer, find us on iTunes. I hope you'll join us again next week, and until then, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.